Welcome to CotiCast, the podcast for debate, discussion, and analysis of issues related to geriatric and general medicine. And we've got the whole gang with us today, so we'll just whiz round and say who we are. I'm Emma.
I'm Christina.
I'm Hannah.
I'm Jelani.
I'm Chris.
Great. And I think we've got some great top tips this week. We've had a little break from CotiCast because we've been busy with COVID. But Christina's going to kick us off with her top tip.
Hello. So in honour of World Delirium Awareness Day that was yesterday, I have a top tip from a meeting I went to about delirium in palliative care and the end of life. It was basically about are we making sure we're not being sidetracked by sort of one of the a more old-fashioned term, terminal agitation, and trying to move away from that term and actually think, are we applying our kind of delirium awareness to patients that become a bit agitated in either palliative care or towards the end of life? And I think traditionally subcut midazolam was a bit of a knee-jerk reaction when people become agitated at the end of life, but we need to make sure that we're thinking about our constipation, urinary retention, pain, all those kind of delirium triggers, and making sure that we're addressing all of those and using, as we would with other form, you know, causes of delirium, using pharmacological methods as a last resort. So just make sure in the context of someone that's palliative or end of life that we're thinking about delirium and being proactive with looking for causes and then using pharmacological treatment as a last resort. It has its place, obviously. That was my tip.
Yeah. Good tip. And Hannah, you're up next.
Great. So mine was based on somebody that I saw on call when I was last week. Who was an elderly lady who'd been admitted and labelled as septic and delirious. So after a couple of days, wasn't really getting any better and was becoming really, really agitated and started having some twitching of her muscles. And it actually turned out that she had serotonin syndrome, which is something that I'd never actually seen before in clinical practice. And it's just something that always seemed to come up on exams. So I thought that was quite interesting. And she'd been on long-term tramadol, so escitalopram, and then someone has added in tramadol, and that's what had precipitated it all. So serotonin syndrome is a syndrome that occurs when your body has too much serotonin, and it's normally caused due to a combination of medicines, normally the SSRIs and the MOIABs, but things such as opioids and antiemetics such as ondansetron and mesothiopamide can trigger it as well. So I think if you've got a patient who's got an altered mental status, neuromuscular dysfunction like tremors or some weird clonus and autonomic disturbance that isn't getting better, it's always something to think about and think about doing creatinine kinase. And it was really interesting to see, because like I said, I've never seen it before. So I learned a lot from that.
No, I've never seen it before either. That's a very good point.
That's so weird, and just because recently on my own call, there was someone who had an overdose of like a lot of interacting medication, real hyperreflexia and clonus and things like that. And I'd never seen clonus like it before. And I was just like, you know, it just keeps beating. And is the CK usually quite raised?
Yeah. So I think hers was about 3,000,
which
was fairly good going. And she had this persistent pyrexia that just was not getting better, and a tachycardic, and she was really, really sweaty as well.
So. Right. And what treatment did she need?
So we ended up giving her quite a lot of benzodiazepines.
Yeah.
We stopped the medications, and then we got psych involved, and we gave her quite a lot of benzodiazepines, more than I would have probably felt comfortable doing with out there help, and she did get better.
So. Yeah, that's really interesting. And it's interesting about tramadol, isn't it? Because that's not one that would usually click with me to think of serotonin syndrome tramadol, but that's a really good learning point.
It lowers your seizure threshold as well.
Yeah. Oh, top tip all round. great, fab. And Chris, I think you're up next.
Yeah, so obviously I'm the sort of resident strokeologist in the AME committee, but I thought that I would probably just try and bust a couple of myths that I've kind of encountered people talking about in clinical practice recently, and there's two main ones, and one is we tend to quantify stroke severity according to something called the NIHSS, which is the National Institutes for Health Stroke Scale, which is essentially a score from 0 to 42 that quantifies how severe someone's stroke is. And 0 is perfectly normal, and 42 is all the way up to being dead because the stroke's that severe. And I've certainly spoken to a number of people that work in ED and also medical trainees who think that there are certain NIHS score cutoffs for thrombolysis. So people have to have a certain score in order to warrant being given alteplase for thrombolysis in ischemic stroke, and there isn't a number that would make me, as somebody that does stroke, thrombolize or not thrombolize. And people who are completely normally, independently, functionally fit and well can have an NIH score of 2 if they are aphasic with no other symptoms, which can sometimes happen if they have an ischemic cortical stroke. But you certainly would thrombolize someone who can't speak, who would normally be able to speak. So I think that's one of the things that I would say, is that there is no real cutoff or lower limit for thrombolysis, and people might be madly weak down one arm and a leg, but not be able to walk independently. And if they normally can walk independently, that's still classed as a disabling stroke, and they would warrant being thrombolized. So that there is no number in the NIHS score that means that you wouldn't thrombolize someone. It very much depends on what the deficit is and what that means for them based on what their normal is. And the second one that I've come across is obviously traditionally we've always thought that wake-up stroke is one of those things that we can't do anything about. And it's kind of, you know, tough cookie. Unfortunately, we don't know when it's happened. It's probably over 4.5 hours, or it might not be. And if it isn't, then we don't know what time it came on because people were well the night before. And we're now starting to very much move away from a time-based method of deciding who should or shouldn't be thrombolized. And there is a trial that's ongoing at the minute called TWIST, which is using a new kind of drug called tenecteplase for people that wake up and present to hospital within 4.5 hours of waking with symptoms. And if they have a normal CT head scan with no obvious ischemia or bleeding, then they would meet the criteria to go into that trial to possibly be thrombolized. And equally, there was a trial that was done, it was about 2018, called Wake Up, which was done at UCL using MRI to see whether people have got mismatches on the different kind of sequences on MRI. So if you're very lucky to work in a hospital where you've got a stroke service that can get access to MRI very quickly for these people, we can still be thrombolizing people who have woken up with symptoms. I mean, it's not a catch-all for people that with wake-up stroke, but it's just to bear in the back of your mind, just because people have woken up with the symptoms, if they get to hospital quickly, they can still have these kind of treatments, and it's worth referring to your local stroke team early on, because they're obviously very effective treatments that can massively influence somebody's outcome. So just worth keeping in mind.
And what's the score thing? Is that a historical thing? Because I'm sure I remember being taught about the NIHSS score, you know, if about kind of the number range. So is that kind of historical lag that...
Yeah, I think it probably comes from the original trials that have been done looking at the safety and efficacy of thrombolysis for ischemic stroke, and the kind of strokes that were kind of included in the trials, essentially. And it's just one of those things that kind of just gets passed down through folklore in medicine, or, you know, one department has a view about what should or shouldn't be done. And I think, you know, I mean, the last one I heard was, you know, well, we don't thrombolize people with an NIH score of less than 5, you know, which you can kind of see how that gets passed down. But realistically, you know, as I said, you know, you could be completely aphasic and have an NIH score of 2. So that doesn't really fit either. So just worth thinking about.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Do they all have to have a CT angiogram?
Yeah, the Wake Up trial was it was predominantly MRI based, but if it was accessible, they should have also had CTA in that trial as well. But basically, you're looking at a mismatch between what's called the DWI sequences and the FLAIR sequences to see whether or not they are probably within the time window to be given the treatment. But I mean, you know, now, I mean, certainly where I'm working at the minute, we're very much looking at trying to extend the time windows, because if they've not got obvious ischemia on the scans already, you know, you know, what is the real bleeding risk there, even though we, you know, the arbitrary time cutoff has come through the trials. So obviously those are the factors involved, but we're definitely looking at moving away from this just, you know, well, it's, you know, it's 4 hours 35, so you've missed the boat by 5 minutes. That's not how we should be doing things.
What a fast moving progressive field. I can see why you like it, the specialty.
So for those of us kind of say working in DGHs or people working overnight and who don't have access to like MRIs and stuff, what should we be doing with these wake up?
It's very difficult, and that's the thing, it very much depends upon the resource that you have. As I said, if you are working, even DGHs are participating in this trial that's called TWIST, which is just using plain CT brain scanning for wake-up strokes. Mm-hmm. So if you are working somewhere that is enrolled in that trial, then they can still be enrolled in that, even if you don't have easy access to MRI, which, you know, I all know if you're working in a district general hospital, your access to MRI is limited anyway. And, you know, if there's a cord recliner on the table or, you know, I appreciate that these things are not easy. And if you're in a tertiary neurosciences center, your experience is very different to if you're in a rural district general hospital. I totally get that.
Think about these things, isn't it? It's not to say, oh, as you said, they're 4.5, you know, 5 minutes over, or they woke up. And sometimes actually in hindsight, then they were awake an hour before or something and they were fine, weren't they? But you never ask that. So it's maybe just...
Yeah. And I think that's probably another thing that's even a bit more fundamental than the access to fancy imaging modalities is, you know, are you 100% sure that the story is clear? And if you are not, is there anything else that can try and corroborate that, whether it be a family member at home or, you know, even if it is, you know, I mean, we've had wake up stroke recently that, you know, it's coming in at 6 a.m, 5:45 a.m. because people are up early for work at 5:30 or 5:15, and you would think, oh cracky, well, what were they doing up at that time? But actually, if you speak to people's partners or relatives or whatever to really establish exactly what happened and where, then if you can really, you know, nitpick it down, you often get a different history to what you're initially presented with when you're referred, which I think is also quite important. So I think if you can try and be, you know, pretty nitpicky about it. I mean, I would say that because, you know, stroke is what I really like, but you know, I think we're doing a disservice to people if we can't give them this treatment that they might be eligible for. So
yeah, because it could have a huge impact on their future functioning, couldn't it?
Yeah absolutely. Cool.
Such a common presentation as well, isn't it? Like, you always get referred to someone waking up with weakness or can't speak, and so
and equally, you know, if we can get vascular imaging, then people might be candidates for thrombectomy, which is obviously, you know, another contentious issue that I won't go into, but you know, there are lots of treatments that people can be eligible for if we do things properly the first time, so just worth bearing in mind.
That's really good tips. So I'm the same as Christina, just because it's World Delirium Awareness Day. I'm also doing just like some top tips about delirium, just basically simple things about what we should be doing, especially for kind of juniors, if you're working on the acute medical take or on the Jerry's ward. And it's mainly things about, first of all, just suspect it, you know, in people who have had previous deliriums or have cognitive impairment or in with infection or have a list of about 20 medications, because they're going to be more at risk. And if you suspect it, you're more likely to spot it. And don't just write confusion, just write what it is, delirium, in the notes, because that also is going to highlight to people on the post-take ward round that, you know, this patient has delirium. And we know that people who have delirium are increased risks of kind of morbidity and mortality in hospital, even if they present with the same infection as someone in the bed next to them who hasn't got delirium. In terms of spotting it, because often you kind of think, oh, this person's not quite right, or you write, oh, they're kind of slightly confused, but use a tool, I think, because that will help you clarify, and it just kind of makes your diagnosis more firm. So things like the 4AT or the CAMS, or even just do a really quick screening of their attention. So a test of attention, like the months of the year backwards, for example. So yeah, and once you've spotted it, write it in the notes, and then that can be addressed. Because I think, is there a statistic where about 1 in 5 people never get back to their baseline function who have had delirium? So it's going to probably have a huge impact. And then with that, try and prevent it. So if you have an elderly person who's come with infection, you've identified at risk of delirium, then try and do a few things to reduce their risk of getting it. So making sure they've got their glasses, making sure they don't get constipated, thinking about their bowels, checking their charts, making sure they can reach their drink, making sure they don't get dehydrated, and kind of picking up their phone to relatives so that you know what your patients usually like, so that you can tell if actually they're different. That's probably one of the most important things, isn't it? Just hearing from their family, no, this isn't them. This isn't what they're usually like. So yeah, they're my few top tips. What do you guys use for, do you use the 4AT or?
Yeah, 4AT on admission.
It's in quite a lot of the clerking booklets nowadays as well, the 4AT, I find. Sometimes if you just flip through, it's actually there, because it's quite difficult to remember it all in your head, but it often just prompts you with all the questions.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, and it is foolproof as well. Yeah. Like, with it in front of you, it's a foolproof tool, I think.
And I was reading about it, and I think the people who developed it, they wanted to develop it so you couldn't have an untestable, you know, so you couldn't say, oh, we can't test this person because, you know, they're too drowsy, because that mark, that gives you marks on the 4AT. So you can never have like an untestable result. So yeah, kind of basically foolproof for us.
I think, like you said, having it down as a diagnosis as well is really important, because some families, it can be quite distressing when their relative is confused. So having that diagnosis that this is a delirium and this is what it is, I think is quite helpful. And when I often speak to families on the phone, don't know what delirium is, and when you explain it, it's quite reassuring to them that, oh, they have a diagnosis, this is what it is. And, you know, there's often an underlying cause that we're treating. So telling them is really important.
And give them a time frame, like, we hope this will get better as we treat this, and sometimes it can last, just so people kind of know what to expect. And also, I think with no visiting with COVID, it's really hard for families, because, you know, they've got no idea what's going on. They're not seeing their relative daily or weekly in hospital. And often, like before COVID, it was families coming up to you and saying, oh, my mum just doesn't seem right. And that would trigger people to kind of look for delirium, whereas we're not having that at the moment, are we? So we've got to be a bit more aware.
I think that having sort of been on the other end of it relatively recently, that concept of time seems to be very slow when you've got a relative who's in hospital, and the only kind of contact that you have is sort of phone updates with nursing staff intermittently. And, you know, sort of the fact that delirium changes, so it's very fluctuant even within a day, let alone sort of over the space of days, plural. It just, you know, I think it just must be tremendously hard, particularly if your only method of seeing people is maybe by FaceTime or a phone call, and 1 minute they're, you know, very flat, and then it's, you know, well, yeah, they're a bit agitated and they've had a fall because they've been confused, and how that must feel on the other end of the telephone must be pretty unpleasant. So, you know, Dilly, I think, as you were saying, sort of explaining the nature of it is probably very important, so that they understand that 1 minute they might be quite agitated and then at other times might be very flat and very sleepy because of the nature of what delirium is, so that they understand that it's just the brain's abnormal response to being poorly or whatever trigger has caused it. So I think it's very important.
And it's so important, isn't it? Because it can be so distressing, because, you know, as we've all seen, like, patients with their delirious, they might pick up the phone and ring off their mobiles to their families, kind of distressed or upset. And
so the police.
Yeah. So families are getting these kind of distressing phone calls, and especially when they can't come and visit, it's awful.
I think the important thing about having delirium written in the notes and acknowledged is it can get the patient access to support, and may trigger a referral to, if the hospital has it, you know, delirium dementia outreach team, specialist nurses, having the word actually written.
And sometimes they follow up in the community as well, because it's people who have delirium. Exactly. Are at more at risk of having kind of cognitive impairment in the future, aren't they? Great. Okay. Last but not least.
Hi, everyone. My top tip was just to chat to people about who, when you see like older patients on the acute take or on the ward, just sort of to remember that sometimes they're blood results and investigations and things like that might lag a bit behind their clinical presentation. So often you'll get history either from the families or the patient themselves that feeling a bit more muddled, or perhaps they're not as steady on their feet or a bit more confused. And when you do the bloods or chest x-rays or whatever the test you might do, they might come back normal, but it doesn't necessarily mean that there isn't something going on. It might take a bit of time before that actually any blood results become abnormal. And really just the importance of the history, whether that be from the patient or, you know, tying into delirium from family members, or like the, even the MDT. So if you're talking to some of the physiotherapists, and like yesterday, your patient might have been a bit steadier on their feet and today they're not as good, just to bear that in mind, that that might be the first sign that someone's perhaps developing a delirium or deteriorating, and just how important that examination and history is from the patient. And it can work the other way as well. When patients are getting better, sometimes they get better much quicker than actually their lab results get better. So just bear that in mind and take everything together, and perhaps use your investigations as a tool to guide you, but bearing in mind that like the most important thing in our patients is like history, and the examination will really help you, I think.
Yeah, I suppose as well, just as everyone says, that our elderly patients present atypically in everything, don't they?
Sometimes they can't tell you as well what's wrong, particularly our patient with dementia or delirium. They won't be able to tell you where it hurts or when they became constipated or things like that. So I think speaking to their families and just or any other people in the ward who are looking after them is really important.
Yeah, I think it's I'm a big advocate of kind of writing your thought process in the notes so that people understand what it is that you think of what's going on. And sometimes, you know, the answer is there is something that's not right, but I'm not quite sure, but it's definitely not normal and it's okay to not know. I think is that, you know, and as you said, you know, we probably just need a bit of time for something to rear its head. We're not quite sure what it is, but we know that there is something that's abnormal, and sometimes time is what you need for that to come out. And you don't have to say, well, because I can't find anything, there's nothing wrong, because, you know, as we discussed, it's not the right answer. So I think, you know, don't be afraid to kind of write that you're concerned that there is something that's not right, but we're just not sure what it is yet. I think that's okay.
Because I think probably sometimes we're a bit scared to do that. And I think that's really good to say, look, something's not right. I don't know, but let's be safe and keep them in work.
Yeah, you can't know everything all the time. Maybe it's something that comes with getting older and more senior, as you're less afraid to say that you don't know at the moment, but time will tell.
Yeah. And maybe because we're just brought up to kind of think that it's not okay to not know through the kind of education system, and everything always leads to a diagnosis. And that's the way that we're kind of taught and examined throughout our careers. Yeah. The undergraduate or MRCP or whatever it is, there is always an answer that we have to have. And I think, you know, it's only going to get more of a problem with time, that everybody's living longer with more and more complex health problems. And often, it's, you know, sometimes there isn't necessarily a diagnosis. It is a problem list. And it's about how you manage all of them together, which is, you know, I suppose part of the beauty of being a geriatrician is that's not easy, but it's actually quite interesting and quite challenging at the same time.
Yeah, I think probably us as hospital doctors are less good at using time, whereas I think in GP, they use time a lot, don't they, as kind of like a diagnostic tool. Mm-hmm. And that's like a real skill that they have that we're perhaps kind of lacking in hospital specialties as well, because we have such easy access to investigations and all the support that we have in an inpatient setting that you don't have in the kind of community as much.
And it's all those external pressures as well. I mean, you know, no more is it more apparent than a minute with kind of patient flow and beds and how much space have you got. And it's kind of not acceptable for somebody to have a day where you don't really know what's going on and you don't necessarily have that luxury. But you know that if you were going to send them home, then they would probably be back, you know, in a few days and worse and have a worse outcome. So it's just, you know, don't be afraid to stand your ground and say that things, you know, that you might need to hang on to somebody even though you don't quite know what's going on. I think that's not unreasonable.
Yeah, definitely.
Very wise words.
Yes. Well, that was great too. So thank you, everyone. So as ever, our podcasts are available on our iTunes account and our website, which is www.aeme.org.uk. And you can find them on our Twitter as well. And our handle is @elderlymeded. So thanks so much, everyone. Bye.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.